You'll know that in the last 3 weeks, last previous 2 weeks, and then this week, we're looking at the subject of leadership in the church, because at the moment, we're looking to appoint new leaders in our own congregation, new members of Kirk Session, and we're at the nomination stage. And I mentioned it earlier, if you have someone to nominate and you've asked them and they've said yes, you can pop the paper in the box today or next Sunday. And we've been thinking a bit about what the Bible has to say about leadership in the church. And our theme for today is leaders or servants. I was at Tesco the other night with my wife on a date night. While we're walking up through the car park to walk into Tesco's, I see this Vauxhall Vectra. And you could hardly help but notice it. I need to be careful what I say, because maybe somebody here owns it, or you know the person who owns it. But this Vauxhall Vectra looked like this. I should have taken a picture of it at the time, but this is what it actually looked like. Okay, so it was an ordinary car from this part of the world, but it was painted and had all the markings on it of an LAPD patrol car. Okay, everything, the logos, the badge, the number on the top of the roof, the bar with the lights on it, and all that, had the works, the lot, okay, painted black and white just like that. What I didn't know was that in the 1950s, the LAPD, the Los Angeles Police Department, had a competition to ask people to come up with a logo, a motto for the department. And they invited the officers in the force to suggest names, and one police officer suggested a motto. And the motto was adopted initially by the police academy, and then in the early 1960s by the force in Los Angeles, and it is now a motto which is probably known worldwide. You probably knew it. I didn't know it till I saw it on the Vauxhall Vectra in the car park in Tesco's last week. The motto of the Los Angeles Police Department is, if you can see it on the screen, to protect and to serve. To protect and to serve. And that's a bit weird when you think about it. To protect and to serve. The protect bit, maybe you can get, but the bit that says that they are there to serve, I mean, these are people who hold authority. They carry firearms. They enforce justice. In what sense do they serve? If they've just stopped you for a speeding violation, you probably don't feel served, and you may not feel protected. So how on earth can a police force have a motto it says to protect and to serve? Because the reality is that even for people in positions of authority, to exercise that authority rightly feels like serving the people that you work with. And in this passage, which we read from Matthew chapter 20 a moment or two ago, Jesus draws attention to how leadership in the church is the same. He says, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. Jesus doesn't deny that there are positions of authority. Jesus doesn't deny that when we get to meet him at the end of time, there will be stars in the constellation of the Christian church. There will be people who stand out. Why will they stand out? They will stand out because they served. That's why. Now, we already have touched to some extent upon this reality, because we talked in the first of these three sermons about the fact that those who are leaders are, first of all, followers. That the key thing about leading in the Church of Jesus Christ is that you have to be a follower of Jesus Christ. And that was really the only thing Jesus ever asked of the disciples. It was his initial command when he called them together and they formed the band, the company of those who would live with him for 3 years and then who would, by the power of his Holy Spirit, plant the Christian church. He only ever asked them to do one thing: follow me. And we need leaders who will restore to the church that intimate, personal connection to Jesus. So easy for the church to become so busy about all the good stuff it does and yet not realize the fact that they have severed connection with the one person who makes them the church, Jesus Christ himself. At the leadership conference in London, start of the week, the conference started off with Nicky Gumbel interviewing Justin Welby, the new Archbishop of Canterbury. And I know you're fed up with me mentioning him, but he is an incredible person. And in the remarks that he made in response to one of the questions Nicky asked him, he quoted from somebody else. I wasn't quick enough to pick up who the quote was from, but this was what he said. If Jesus isn't at the center of the church, we are just rotary with a pointy roof. See what he's saying? That if Jesus isn't at the center of the church, we can do loads of good things, you know, but we're just rotary with a pointy roof. So we have to be careful that leaders are followers, that they are seeking to keep an intimate connection between Jesus and the church. But those who are leaders in the church are more than followers. They are more than followers because people follow lots of things. You might follow a sporting team. You might follow a series on TV. You might follow someone on Twitter. But there are times when other things come first, when you can't watch the series on the TV because something much more important needs to be done, or when you can't go to a particular football or rugby game because there are family needs that have to be attended to. So when you follow people, that doesn't necessarily mean that they are first on your list of priorities. This is not true, however, of following Jesus. Jesus said this in John 12, "Whoever serves me must follow me, and where I am, my servant also will be. My Father will honor the one who serves me." It's not enough to be a follower of Jesus Christ. If you aspire to be a leader, you must also become a servant of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ must become the single most significant person in your life. Someone above whom no one else or nothing else ever takes priority. That's what it means. Now, Paul understood that from the moment of his conversion. How does he introduce himself to the Romans when he writes to them? Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ. And then when he writes to the Corinthians, dealing with the thorny problems of congregational life there, he says to them while he's trying to instruct them, how should you see us? He says, this then is how you ought to regard us. The servants of Christ. And this is really important. Those who lead the church are not in charge. Let me say that again. Those who lead the church are not in charge. That's the way the world works. It's not the way the church works, or it's not the way the church should work. Jesus points that out in verse 25. Remember what he said? You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. Not so with you. Jesus said the people who lead the church are not in charge. So who is in charge then? Has Jesus replaced the tyranny of a king by the tyranny of the people? Well, sometimes when you hear people who attend Presbyterian churches, you would think that that's what Jesus did. That Jesus removed the authority of the people who are leaders so that the people could dictate, that that's what church is all about. Of course, that's not what Jesus is saying. What point would there be in having a leader who asked me what he or she should do? I don't need a leader like that. I can make my own mind up about that. I need a leader who will lead me. I went with my father-in-law to the accident emergency department of the Mater Hospital about 4 or 5 weeks ago. It was late at night. We sat together in a cubicle in accident emergency for about 4 hours. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, a young, very competent, very pleasant doctor came to speak to us. And he went through a few examinations with my father-in-law and then suddenly realized that the situation was quite serious. And so by this time, he knew that we had been in and out of the accident emergency department quite a number of times in the last couple of years. So having examined my father-in-law, he then turned around and he looked at me, and this is what he said. He said, "And what do we do when he's like that?" Okay? So this is the doctor in the hospital accident emergency department asking me what I think he should do next. What I know about medicine could be written on the back of a postage stamp. And I looked at him and I said, "Pardon?" He said, "But what do we do when he's like that? Well, I said, and I told him what had happened the last three or four times he'd been in hospital. Fine, he said, that's what we'll do. I didn't feel led at that point in time. What would be the point in a leader who asked me what I want him to do? That's not leading anybody. I need a leader to tell me what he thinks I need to do so I can follow. In the Church of Jesus Christ, Jesus didn't replace the tyranny of the king with the tyranny of the mob. He replaced the tyranny of the king with the lordship of himself. He is in charge. Jesus said that a day and age in which the people dictated to the leaders was a day and age that marked the end of this age. He says through Paul, the time will come when people will not put up with sound doctrine. Instead, to suit their own desires, they will gather around them a great number of teachers to say what their itching ears want to hear. You see, when the people start dictating to the leaders, we're in a bad place. The leaders we are looking for are servants of Christ. He is in charge. Standing on a boat in real trouble in the middle of the Adriatic Sea, on his way to appear before Caesar to be judged by the highest court of the empire, Paul, the great church planter, tries to encourage the sailors that he's in the boat with by giving them a message that an angel gave to him the night before. And this is what he says about the message. He says, last night an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve stood beside me. So this is the question to ask yourself. Whose is the person I'm going to nominate for leadership in this church? Because that person needs to belong to only one. Paul says, "Whose to whom I belong and whom I serve." Is that person, who does that person belong to whose name you've written on a nomination form? Because the important person they need to belong to is to Jesus Christ, because it's Jesus who's in charge and not us. But for the person being nominated, how will this leadership be experienced? We're going to appoint, nominate to leadership people who belong to Christ and who will serve Christ and who will listen to him, not to us, but to him. He'll tell us what they think it is that Jesus is asking us to do. What are you letting yourself in for if you allow your name to go on the paper? Mostly up to now, I've been talking to the people doing the nominating. This morning, I want to finish by saying a couple of things to the people who might be nominated. I'm delighted to hear conversations going on all around the church the last couple of weeks. Loads of people have said to me that people have spoken to them, asked them to consider. I think that's great. I want to thank you for doing that, for being prayerful, diligent about it. Thank you very much. But supposing you're one of those people that others have come to, what about you? What are you letting yourself in for? Well, in those verses we read a moment or two ago, Jesus uses two powerful metaphors to tell you what it's going to feel like. And here's the first one. He says there's a cup to drink. The mother of James and John, the sons of thunder, her name was probably Salome, and she was probably Jesus' aunt, Mary's sister. She comes to Jesus with a request. In the chapter before the one we read, Jesus had talked about his followers sitting on 12 thrones. You'll see that if you want to read Matthew chapter 19. And Salome wants her boys to have the big ones. She says this, "Grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right hand and the other at your left in your kingdom." There are going to be 12 thrones. There's a seat for everybody, but I want my two boys, one either side of you. This is not unusual for a mother and her son. You can understand here that Israelite society is just like Irish society. To mothers, there's nobody like their sons. So, I want my two sons, one either side. Jesus' reply is not what she or they expected. Jesus says, "You don't know what you're asking. Can you drink the cup I am going to drink?" What does that mean? That expression is an Old Testament allusion. Frequently, if you know your Old Testament, you'll know that the prophets of Israel often talked about evil leaders and people and nations drinking a cup of wrath. Here's one example in the prophet Jeremiah. He says in chapter 25, take from my hand, this is God talking to the prophet, take from my hand this cup filled with the wine of my wrath and make all the nations to whom I send you drink it. So in the Old Testament, the cup, the picture of the cup, which was the wrath of God, was given to those who had been evil, who had defied the will and the purposes of God, whether they were people, whether they were a nation, or whether they were groups of people. Didn't matter. If they had defied God, they were given the cup of the wrath of God to drink. And the people who had defied the Lord and broken his will and defied his purposes were the people who got to drink the cup. So why would Jesus be drinking that cup? Why would he be drinking that cup? He was the Son of the Father. He was the faithful one. Why would he be drinking the cup? Because, of course, he was also the Lamb of God who bears away the sin of the world. The cup he would drink was not his cup. It was the cup of the Father upon the evil of the world. And Jesus would have to go to a dark place to drink a cup which was not his. And so would James and John. For Jesus says, you will indeed drink from my cup. James would be the first of the 12 disciples to be martyred. And for you and me, this call of Christ to drink the same cup might not mean physical death, but you know what, men and women? It will mean suffering. Jesus said there is one key principle to all spiritual growth in John chapter 12. Unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains all by itself. If it dies, though, it will produce lots of fruit. You cannot be a leader unless you drink the cup. There is a cup to drink. There will be a cost. Other people will do things in the Church of Jesus Christ and they won't care, and it will break your heart, because that's what it means to be a leader. The cup is not yours. It is the bad behavior, the poor attitude, the lack of commitment, the sinfulness of others, but it is you who will feel the burden of that fault, and it is you who will carry the cost. How far are you prepared to go? How much are you willing to pay? For those who are called to be leaders in the Church of Jesus Christ, there is a cup to drink. But there is also dust to stir. When the other 10 disciples heard about the conversation that these two and their mum had had with Jesus, they were, as we would say, fit to be tied. What they thought was going on was pretty obvious. This was the bit about blood being thicker than water. Remember, Salome was a relative of Jesus. She was his aunt. James and John were probably Jesus' cousins, okay? And here's the family kind of rolling in, you know, saying, well, look, all these other people are really good. They're very, very nice people. But remember, Jesus, these are your cousins here. They need to be in the top seats. But Jesus turns the situation on its head. Once again, his own life is the model. This is what he says. Whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. What Jesus is saying here, leadership in the church is about service, and not the service of some to all the rest, but the mutual service of everyone. That's what it's meant to be. Jesus is not just calling leaders to serve. He's calling them to serve in a particular way, so that through them serving in a particular way, everyone else gets to serve also. When in Ephesians, Paul is talking about the gift of Christ to the church in terms of leadership, this is what he says. So Christ himself gave the apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, and teachers to equip his people for works of service. Leaders are appointed to create a culture of service. A culture of service among the leadership team, one to another. A culture of service between leaders and people. A culture of service between the church and the world. They are called to lead us to serve. So what will that mean? The Bible, New Testament word for a servant is diakonos. It's a Greek word from which we get the English word deacon. And that Greek word is interesting. It's made of two parts, as Greek and Latin words often are. And the basic idea behind that word is this. That word means to raise up dust by hurrying, and hence to serve. Okay, that's the basic idea behind it, is to raise up dust by hurrying. You know, if somebody's going really fast and it's like things are flying off them and dust is going everywhere, that's the picture of the word diakonos. And in Romans chapter 12, Paul talks about leadership in this way. He says this, talking about the gifts of God to the church. We have gifts that differ, he says, and we must use them appropriately. If leading, with energy, or as the NIV says, with diligence. Service means to stir up dust by hurrying. It is talking about people exercising the gift of service with energy, with diligence, with enthusiasm. They are wanting to get there, wanting to be a part of it, giving themselves to it in every way that they can. We need to pay attention if we're going to be leaders in the church. We need to pay attention to the role that God has given us to do. Leaders are not called to do everybody else's job. That's one of the problems with leadership in the church. Micromanagement. Sometimes a session wants to know every little detail of everything everybody else is doing. That's not a leader's job. A leader's job is to do what they have been called to do and let the other people get on with the things that they have been called to do. The leader's job is to create a culture of service by modeling it themselves. To pay attention to the detail of their calling. Last week, we acquired a new photocopier in church. The bulletin you have in your hand this morning was printed on it. It's a bit classier. It does all sorts of things the last one wouldn't do. And the biggest advantage of it is it's going to cost us less. So what about that? More functionality, less money. Brilliant. So the guys arrived with it. Actually, they had four of these photocopiers to install that day. One of them in our place, three of them in the Ulster Bank. So the van arrived here the first thing in the morning, dropped ours off, and headed on to the Ulster Bank with the other three. A little while later, the software engineer, he turned up to do the install, get the machine plugged in, get it up and running. And while he was here then, I was busy running around, along with Gary Bell, installing the software and all the other PCs and computers about the place to make sure that they could print to the new machine. And we'd spent several hours doing this by now. It's after dinner time. And the salesman turns up, okay? And just to check that everything was okay and to make sure that we, his customers, were happy with the deal that he had done. And I'm over in Brian's office in the church halls installing the drivers for the printer on his laptop when the salesman comes in and says, "There's a problem." I said, "What do you mean there's a problem?" "Sure, we've got it all sorted." No, he says, "No, there's a problem." I said, "What's the problem?" He said, "That machine sitting over in your office is not yours. Belongs to the Ulster Bank. They've got yours." And to be honest, when the machine came in, I did notice that it said, you can't see it on screen there, but at the top it says Color Cube, which is the name of the machine, 9303. On all the literature they'd given us, okay, when we were looking at what machine we would buy, it said Color Cube 9301. But I thought, well, it's taken us several months to get to this point. And in the meantime, they brought out a new model and we got the newer model. Great. What I didn't know was actually that wasn't the case at all. The 9303 is twice as fast as the 9301. We couldn't afford it. And part of me said to myself, you know what? The Ulster Bank messed up so many people's bank accounts and kept us sitting here for months. Stuff the Ulster Bank. Just let the machine stay here. Took them long enough to sort out my bank account when their computers went down. So let's just hold on to it for a little while. See if they... No, he said, we can't do that. He said, I mean, my manager will be in all sorts of trouble about that. We're going to have to swap them over. But you see the point? He was diligent about his work. The delivery man's job was to leave a machine off here. The machines are identical. They're absolutely identical. The only way I can tell the difference is that number on the front of the panel. Apart from that, they are absolutely identical. His job was to drop off a machine at the church. He did that. Software engineer's job was to install a machine so it worked on our network. He did that. The salesman's job was to check that the machine we got was the machine we bought, and he was diligent about his work. He did what he is supposed to do. So they came back with a proper machine, and now it only works at half the speed, and we're all disappointed. But anyway. And we are called as leaders. The metaphor that Jesus gives us here is that there is dust to stir. We are called as leaders to be diligent about what we were called to do, not to be poking our nose into what other people are called to do, not to be constantly discouraging by making it look like as if nobody else is capable but us. That's not our job. It wasn't the salesman's job to tell a software engineer how to install a machine in our network. That was his job. Let him get on with it. It was the salesman's job to make sure we had the right machine. And it's the leader's job to make sure that they, in this church, use their gifting and calling to introduce a culture of service, to model it themselves, and then to introduce it among us. That's their job. And you and I, who are ordained leaders in this church, will ultimately be called to answer on how well or otherwise we succeeded in doing that job. So if you have been nominated, there are two things to think about. The first one is that there is a cup to drink. Believe me, leadership in a church is no picnic. There will be days when other people could care less and your heart will be broken. But how much are you willing to pay? And there's dust to stir. This is not a little hobby that will occupy a few hours for you now and again. This is something that requires energy and diligence and enthusiasm. Because see, if you don't do this job, nobody else is going to do it because it's not their responsibility. That's the kind of calling Jesus gives you. Those are the kind of people we're looking to appoint. Band are going to come and sing a song while the offering is lifted. I know normally we talk and chat, and that's fine. I'd love you to listen to what the words of this song are. It's a song called The Stand. And this song kind of meditates upon